From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A spokesman for the National Transportation Safety Board says both of the trains involved in the deadly crash near the nation's capital last night were moving at the time of the collision. At least 11 people were killed in the crash. John Golia of the NTSB says the collision was not quite head-on, but essentially head-on. More from NPR's Dan Charles.
Investigators have refused to speculate on the cause of the crash. They spent the night examining electronic records from each train's locomotive and from the railway control center. Each locomotive carries equipment that records the train's speed and location, much like an airplane's flight data recorder. One passenger from the commuter train told the Washington Post that moments before the crash, conductors rushed into the car screaming, "Everybody down!" All of the deaths reportedly occurred aboard the commuter train, which is much smaller than the Amtrak train. The commuter train was carrying only 17 passengers along with three crewmen. 14 of the passengers were trainees with the Department of Labor's Job Corps program, traveling to Washington, D.C. from a training center in West Virginia. Officials have not released identities of the victims. This is Dan Charles in Washington.
A jury in Boston has awarded a man more than $19 million for a 1990 accident that killed his wife and three children. Paul Santos Jr. says Chrysler knowingly built his Plymouth Voyager minivan with a defect that caused the rear brakes to lock up before the front brakes. He says that caused his vehicle to veer into oncoming traffic. A lawyer for Chrysler says the company may appeal. Leaders of the Balkan nations have begun an emergency summit meeting in Rome aimed at ironing out disputes over the Bosnian peace accord. Regina Sansaloni reports.
American envoy Richard Holbrooke summoned the three presidents of former Yugoslavia to the Italian capital this weekend to try to solve the most serious disputes since the peace plan was signed last December. Also present will be representatives from the so-called contact group, which includes Germany, Russia, France, Britain, and the U.S. At the center of the debate will be the unification of the Bosnian capital Sarajevo and the ancient city of Mostar, as well as the procedure on arresting accused war criminals. Holbrooke is expected to apply the same high-pressure tactics he used in Dayton in order to renew momentum on implementation of the agreement. Talks will begin this afternoon at the Italian Foreign Ministry, then move to nearby Villa Madama, a 16th-century estate which overlooks the capital. For National Public Radio, this is Regina Sansaloni in Rome.
The results of the investigation into the death of Army Sergeant Donald Dugan in Bosnia have been announced. Dugan died 2 weeks ago from an explosion in a minefield. A spokesman for the U.S. peacekeeping force in Bosnia says Dugan cut a tripwire and inserted a probe into a landmine in an attempt to disarm the device. You're listening to NPR News. President Clinton is calling for changes in campaign financing.
We must do everything we can to ensure that we open, not limit, the political process. Our goal is to take the reins of our democracy away from big special interests, from big money, and to put them back into the hands of ordinary Americans where they belong.
In his weekly radio address, Mr. Clinton proposed giving candidates free television time to make their case to voters as a way of discouraging the influence of big money in election campaigns. Senator Bob Dole is campaigning intensively this weekend. He's determined not to repeat his fate of 1988 by winning Iowa and losing New Hampshire. When he's not taking shots at his opponents, Dole is focusing on President Clinton. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Senator Dole took a turn at the griddle of a diner and posed on the back of a dog sled yesterday. But the real substance of the day was a photo op at a resource center for people without jobs to learn new skills. Dole took the opportunity to blast President Clinton for vetoing the Republican-sponsored welfare reform bill.
1 year, 2 years, 3 years, now we're in the fourth year, Mr. President, and you've done nothing. You haven't granted the waivers, you vetoed the welfare bill, and you're still out there saying, we want to end welfare as we know it. There's something wrong, Mr. President. You can't have it both ways.
Dole sees welfare reform as a key issue in defeating President Clinton. There were provisions, however, in the bill, such as banning assistance to teenage mothers, that Clinton found objectionable. Dole also opposes that provision, preferring to leave such decisions up to the states. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Manchester.
Tugboats have yanked a German passenger ferry away from the rocks and sand shoals off the coast of Denmark. The ferry had been stranded there for 15 hours after apparently being pushed off course by an ice floe. There were no injuries among the 900 or so passengers and crew members aboard. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon.
This campaign has already so demeaned the political process in this country.
Campaign is on fire because America, we don't care about doing television attack ads. We got a vision and an agenda.
The secret of the 1994 election was the fact that Republicans were operating in an environment where
with Bill Clinton and paint a brighter picture of the future based on our principles.
Looking for a mainstream conservative with answers and ideas as we go into the next century, you're concerned about your children.
Well, that's what it sounds like that time of year, huh? Cacophony of candidates, the quadrennial crush of vote seekers, once again congested New Hampshire's highways and town squares. With just 3 days till the New Hampshire primary, we turn to Weekend Edition's Dan Shore to bring us up to date on all. Good morning, Dan.
Morning, Scott.
And Dan, I think it sounds like we've got some microphone problems. Why don't we move you to another microphone here while I wind up on this question? Okay. Dan, follow me as we talk. The Iowa caucuses were held Monday in the finishing lineup, of course, with Senator Dole, Pat Buchanan, Lamar Alexander, then Steve Forbes, all of which inspired Senator Phil Graham to withdraw before this New Hampshire vote. How does this first primary look to you as we enter the last weekend of the campaign?
Well, I think the word cacophony, which I think I heard while I was moving from one mic to the other, is a good word for it. Here we had now nine little candidates, and then one fell off, and then there were eight. But the eight still give the impression to voters in New Hampshire of kids quarreling in their playpen. And the number of voters, Republican voters, who still list themselves as undecided is amazing and suggests that there will be, as in Iowa, not a very big turnout. Mm-hmm. And then, somebody maybe still, maybe Buchanan, maybe Alexander's a kind of an upset protest against all that kid stuff will be launched. But whoever it is who's launched by New Hampshire is going to be launched more with a sigh of resignation than with great acclamation.
Based on what you've seen this week, what did the candidates learn maybe in Iowa?
I think Steve Forbes and also Senator Phil Graham, who you remember boasted a year ago that ready money is a politician's most reliable friend. Mm-hmm. Well, both of them learned that money doesn't always buy happiness. In addition, I think Forbes learned that attack ads can sometimes come back and bite you and that you cannot manipulate all the people all the time. I think I'm somewhat misquoting Lincoln. Thirdly, that maybe you shouldn't switch horses midstream, but it's fine to switch slogans mid-campaign. We hear very little in the past couple of weeks, for example, about balanced budget. That was supposed to be the big issue, but the voters apparently are no longer so terribly interested. Mm-hmm. Now we suddenly hear Senator Dole arrives in New Hampshire and begins talking about, guess what, corporate greed and layoffs of workers. And it looks as though he's borrowing a line here or there from Pat Buchanan, or maybe even from Labor Secretary Robert Reich. The lesson they have not yet learned, I think, is that the more you try to be what the voters want, the less the voters will want you.
Pat Buchanan is plainly getting votes and attention, gathering support. Does his campaign, his theme, seem to you to have staying power?
Well, first of all, I have to stipulate that when I talk about Pat Buchanan that I harbor no ill feelings against Pat Buchanan just because back in 1971 he got very angry with me for criticizing a speech on Catholic parochial schools that he'd written for President Nixon, and next thing I knew I was being investigated by the FBI. I don't hold any grudges. So Pat Buchanan is thunder on the right with a very well articulated populist message of protectionism and xenophobia and unilateralism. Mm-hmm. He is a darling of the Christian right. But as he demonstrated by defending that advisor of his, Larry Pratt, who's been associated with the militias, with white supremacists, he indicates that he sometimes has trouble deciding how far right he ought to go before he begins to lose the mainstream.
President Clinton's coming to New Hampshire today, appearing to be somewhat above any political fray.
Yes, as he enjoys that position. He obviously benefits from all the turmoil among the Republicans. Although I must say some people still say that if President Clinton could run unopposed and lose. But even nature now seems to be working for the president. He's been able to go out to flood-stricken areas from Oregon to Pennsylvania, handing out disaster relief, incidentally making people have some second thoughts about whether the federal government is quite the ogre that the Republicans have painted as being. But, you know, this is just a good week for Clinton, and there'll be bad weeks. The Whitewater mess keeps sort of dripping away like Chinese Whitewater torture.
Ooh. Well, and whatever things are going his way, he still can't get his nominee, the esteemed New York banker Felix Rahatan, on the Federal Reserve Board.
Right. Now, mind you, we're talking about the same Senator D'Amato, who's in charge of Whitewater troubles, is also the chairman of the Finance Committee, which has to confirm the vice chairman of the Fed. And what has happened is that Senator D'Amato says he will not confirm Rohatyn. Well, clearly Senator D'Amato wants to hold positions on the Fed open until maybe a Republican president can make those appointments. And I have a feeling that we're not going to see anybody named by President Clinton who is going to be accepted in that position. But I think there may be another factor, and it's an economic factor. The economy at the moment is showing some signs of weakening. And if that continues, that may hurt President Clinton in the election. Now, Felix Rohatyn favors a monetary policy of stimulating growth more than Alan Greenspan wants to do. And so, if you don't have Rohatyn on the Fed, you will lose that person willing to argue for faster and more growth.
At a significant time.
At a significant time.
Of course, there are not primaries in Russia, but there is a presidential election coming up. Boris Yeltsin announced this week he's running for re-election, even though the polls in Russia show him really at about the same point as Alan Keyes is here in the United States.
Well, you know, Boris Yeltsin went to his hometown of Yekaterinburg to announce his candidacy. Why did he go to his hometown? Well, there is where he has the best approval rating of any town in Russia. You know what that rating is? 17%. This is a very interesting and very important contest. Here's Yeltsin running against Gennady Zyuganov, the communist light candidate. Yeltsin's positioning himself as the last best hope for keeping Russia from going back to communism and dictatorship. The albatross around his neck is Chechnya, a war that he promised to end, but he doesn't say how. It's going to be an exciting election, in many ways more interesting than ours.
The leader of three Balkan nations who signed the agreement in Dayton are meeting in Rome this weekend. Several features of that agreement seem to be at risk. The detention of war criminals, and now, of course, the NATO raid in a building west of Sarajevo, where they arrested three people they identified as Iranian terrorists, and they say this was a center sanctioned by the Bosnian government.
Yeah, well, you know, as Richard Holbrook, the Assistant Secretary, and others have said, this was never going to be a rose garden. It was going to be easy. Last week, the big problem was the arrest of the suspected war criminals, and then a couple of them were extradited to The Hague to be dealt with by the War Crimes Tribunal. And Holbrooke fixed that up for the moment. And then we got a problem that should not have come as a surprise, and that is that Iranian and other Islamic militants had dug themselves in Bosnia. Some of them married Bosnian women. And there is that problem, what to do about these caches of arms and terrorist preparations that were being made. There is still a very big problem about getting people out of Mostar and around Sarajevo who are supposed to move and aren't moving very fast. And so they called together the three presidents of the three parts of former Yugoslavia, summoned to Rome, faced the allies of Russia, and told, hey, fellas, get with the program.
Dan, let me catch up with something with you. There's, of course, a study issued last week demonstrating a link between violence on television and in society. And this week you had the principal broadcast networks indicating they would like to develop an industry code to classify programming.
Yes, I think, well, the networks have apparently thought better about what they were talking about at first of offering a challenge in the courts to the whole effort to enforce V-chips and develop some other standards. This reminds me, oddly enough, of what happened so many years ago in the 20s, I guess it was, when the movie industry decided to go with a voluntary code and set up its Hays office, if you read about that, I remember it, as a way of averting government action. And so they've been talking about, hey, we better get together and do something ourselves and not try to offer defiance or put up a big challenge in the courts when the people really are not with us there. You've got not only President Clinton, but Senator Dole and the Christian right and everybody more or less on this in agreement that something has to be done. So, of course, then you get Rupert Murdoch of Fox Television, ever the maverick, who says
We're running out of time, I'm afraid.
Who said he'll go with the code unilaterally.
Okay. Thanks very much, Dan Shore. A couple of final notes from the week's news out of the New Hampshire primary, where milk, eggs, and roses have become signal issues. Lamar Alexander was asked by a reporter if he knew the price of a gallon of milk and a carton of eggs. He didn't have an answer. Political analyst decreed this non-response put egg on Mr. Alexander's face. He later explained that out of dietary caution, he hasn't eaten an egg in years, and in the midst of a campaign about balancing the billions of the federal budget, just couldn't recall the price of a gallon of milk. But in a time when prices are marked in electric bars, indecipherable to human eyes, Mr. Alexander's answer may win him sympathy, not embarrassment. In recent campaigns, reporters have figured that it's fair to ask candidates a few practical questions about the real world they claim to represent. Remember George Bush and the supermarket checkout line? But by now, the candidates have probably already been rehearsed to recite milk and egg prices in all the primary states, so perhaps reporters should ask, what's the price of a 5-ounce jar of Coyote Cochina hot sauce east of the Colorado River? What's the cost of a 9-ounce jar of maraschino cherries? And could buffalo chicken wings and Jamaican jerk sauce power the Seawolf submarine? Also this week on Valentine's Day, Pat Buchanan gave his wife Shelley a dozen roses. Publicly, romantic that he is, to denounce trade tariffs he says cost 70% of the roses sold in the United States to come from overseas. Making the rose a campaign issue reminded me of a story we reported a few years back about migrant workers in the rose fields of California's San Joaquin Valley. Men, women, and not a few children, immigrants from Mexico and Central America, plunging their faces into acrid, chemical-saturated dirt to prune thorny-stemmed roses with their bare hands, bleeding but slow to stop because leaving to rinse their wounds and bandage their hands would reduce the number of roses they could prune, and they were paid by the plant. The scalding sun, the sulfurous air scalding their lungs. We wonder if Pat Buchanan has seen what it takes to grow roses for sale, and why so many of the immigrants he wants to keep out with an electrified barrier drawn across the border so often do work no one else wants. And the time is now 18 minutes past the hour.